From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Religion writer Lauren Winner describes real sex as committed, loving, and most importantly, married. Her latest book is called Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. She says she wrote it for Christians, but partly because of Winner's own winding spiritual path, the book does pose questions for all of us. Is abstinence until marriage better for society? And what's the relationship between marital fidelity and communal responsibility? Before she became a Christian, Lauren Winner was a practicing Orthodox Jew. She chronicled her conversion in a memoir called Girl Meets God. And she wrote about her efforts to reconcile the two faiths in the book Mudhouse Sabbath, although I suspect, Lauren, there was probably an essence of Madhouse in that effort to reconcile the two. Currently visiting a professor at Duke Divinity School. Welcome to the program, Lauren.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
We welcome your calls as well, 877-962-9862, to talk about spiritual journey, faith, and the role of chastity in not only in society, but in religious faith and in the practice of faith as well. Lauren, you grew up in a mixed faith household in Western North Carolina. You had a Jewish father, you had a lapsed Baptist mother, but raised mostly Jewish. Not Orthodox Jewish. That was your choice. Why did you choose to study that tradition and become an Orthodox Jew?
Well, I did grow up with a strong Jewish identity, and as I entered my teenage years, I think a lot of teenagers sometimes think of things in very black and white, absolute terms, and I began to not understand the logic of Reform and Conservative Judaism. I wanted to say either this is true or this is not true. And if it's true, then embrace it whole hog, to use an inapposite idiom.
Right.
When I was a teenager, I did move fully into Orthodox Judaism.
And you practiced for a while,
mm-hmm.
but then found yourself drawn to Christianity.
Yes, I think my attraction to Christianity began as an intellectual attraction. I was a religion major and a history major in college and was very interested in the history, particularly the American South. It's hard to understand the history of the American South without thinking about Christianity. So I had this intellectual attraction, and I was particularly interested in the doctrine of the incarnation, which is in the Christian calendar what we're about to celebrate, the idea that God became a person. That to me seemed the essential difference between Judaism and Christianity. And before I was ever personally or spiritually attracted to that, intellectually I spent a lot of time thinking about what different spiritual resources that idea gave to Christianity that Judaism didn't articulate in the same ways. And then I began to have some personal experiences, one of which was a dream. It's taken me years to be able to describe this with a quasi-straight face. It was a dream that I had in college that I understood to be about Jesus, and I woke up kind of startled and felt that God had given me this this spiritual dream. I didn't act on that dream. I continued to be an observant Jew for several years. I also read some Christian novels and Christian memoirs that really touched me very deeply. So this happened over a few years' time. I don't have one of those dramatic, dateable road to Damascus conversions.
No, but this dream does sound like a dramatic event, and I'm always curious to know how one decides or how one feels that this dream. And in a sense, it was a rescue fantasy, wasn't it?
It was in the dream, and of course, this is the flakiest sounding part. I had been kidnapped by a group of mermaids, and I was underwater, hanging out with these mermaids, and was indeed rescued by someone that when I awoke, I understood that to be Jesus. I think that as dramatic or epiphanous for me was some of the reading I began to do, again, mostly fiction, that presented fictional characters who were Christians, whose lives seemed really saturated by faith in a way that I did not feel my own life to be. And I don't mean to suggest that one can't live a Jewish life that is equally saturated by faith, but somehow in my own experience, that wasn't happening. So I was very attracted to that.
So did you feel that this dream, and you say the meaning of this dream sort of unfolds slowly for you, it's not all at once, but that the dream was pulling you away from Judaism? It told you that in a sense, we cannot practice these two. These are not different paths up the same mountain.
Well, I wouldn't say it left me thinking anything about Judaism being somehow incomplete. That's not what I mean to suggest. But that I personally was being called towards Christianity.
You said at one point you had this kind of this Daniel Day-Lewis-like vision of Jesus, the mm-hmm. sort of the handsome.
He was really brawny and good looking.
Brawny, yeah. And
not the kind of wimpy Jesus of Renaissance art.
So in your mind, do you love Jesus in the way a woman loves a man?
I think I would answer that yes, with the explanation that I've been married about 2 years now. The feelings sometimes wane. I mean, I think any of us who are married know there are those moments and seasons of real intense emotion, and then there are seasons of thinking, why did I get into this? And then there are seasons that are in between. And I think that is how I would describe my faith life, that there are moments of strong emotional ardor, real emotional ardor. And then there are dry stretches, and there are stretches of frustration. And I think, like a marriage, those of us who are in religious communities and have regular religious practices, those communities and practices sort of take us through the dry spells, and eventually our emotions catch up again with where we are.
You make a lot of that, the both in Judaism and in Christianity, the rhythm of the season and mm-hmm. and how we can sort of conform ourselves to those rhythms in the liturgical calendar.
Yes, and that is something I actually still really, really miss about Judaism. I think the sense of an annual liturgical calendar is definitely present in Christianity, but in America, and particularly among Protestants, that liturgical calendar has not been as robustly inhabited as it is in Judaism. So I have a sense in Judaism, in observant Jewish communities in particular, the rhythm of your life really is fundamentally dictated by and shaped by this religious calendar. As a Christian now, I feel like one of my ongoing efforts is to try to make the Christian calendar the most important calendar in my life. It's very easy to have, April be about paying your taxes, getting your taxes done, rather than have April be about Lent. It's very easy for this season, I think, for Protestants to not be about Advent, which is the church season that we're in, but instead to be about, doing your shopping for Christmas. So I constantly try to make that religious calendar sort of more significant than the academic calendar or the secular calendar or what have you.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation with Lauren Winter, author of Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. She also wrote the book Girl Meets God, talking about her spiritual journey. The process of spiritual awakening and sexual passion are often very closely related, and we talked a little bit about your attraction to the brawny Jesus. But when it comes to chastity, and we want to talk about that as well, there's a lot of confusion, isn't there, about sex and about passion and faith and how we sort of commit ourselves, if we choose to do that, to a faith and to a person. And you see them as very closely related.
Yes. In the Christian landscape, I do think that there's a sexual ethic that is an essential part of Christian discipleship. I don't think it's the only piece of faithful Christian living. I don't think it's the most important piece. I often say, on some level, I wrote this book about chastity because I agree with those people who say the church talks about sex too much. And I think perhaps if we talked about it better, we could then talk about it less.
What is it that the church is now? How could it do so in a better way?
Well, in my own context, in evangelical Protestant churches, there is a lot of energy. My book is really only about the issue of premarital sexuality. It doesn't deal with other aspects of sexual ethics. And there's a lot of energy about telling teenagers, for example, that they need to not have sex before they get married. But there's a lot of scare tactics involved, a lot of negative language as opposed to positive. So there's, you shouldn't have sex because you'll get pregnant, or you shouldn't have sex because you'll get an STD, not a positive articulation of, this is what married sex might look like, and this is the goodness of that. That's real different from what we see on Sex and the City.
But do you think it's important to have sex in the context of marriage, as distinguished from simply a committed relationship?
Right. Well, and this book, Real Sex, is not an autobiography or a memoir, but it was born out of an autobiographical situation, which is that when I became a Christian, I really struggled with knowing that, according to the Christian teaching, I was unmarried, I was not supposed to be having sex, but there I was, a 20-something-year-old woman in Manhattan, and it took me several years to say, I'm going to submit to this teaching. And I do think there is a difference between having sex in a marriage and having sex even in a committed relationship. I mean, the phrase committed relationship is a little elusive in some way. I mean, what is the commitment? What are we committed to? And do we know we're in a committed relationship by the second month of it or after a year? There's something, I think, about what we see happening in a wedding ceremony that I think tells us something about the difference between those supposedly committed relationships and marriages.
I want to talk about those ceremonies and the role of the community mm-hmm. in marriage and how that does distinguish itself from other kinds of relationships as our conversation with Lauren Winner continues. Lauren is a visiting professor at Duke and author of books on spirituality, including Girl Meets God and Real Sex. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Religion writer Lauren Winner has been through two conversions, raised in a mixed faith home in Western North Carolina. She became an Orthodox Jew in college. A few years later, she went to England and came home a committed Christian. And she wrote about those experiences in her memoir, Girl Meets God. Her most recent book, Real Sex, argues for chastity for Christians. Lauren Winner is our guest today. We're taking your phone calls as we look more broadly at that question about chastity and society, chastity and religion, 877-962-9862. So, Lauren, we're talking about the institution of marriage as an important basis for practicing sex. And you talk about the importance of community and make distinctions between the sort of notion that sex is private. And you say, no, it's not. It's a communal affair. It is everybody's business.
Yes, I think that's right. Certainly, sexuality can be personal, but there are also real public and communal consequences to our sexuality. And some of the analogies I like to think of have to do with public school funding or art exhibits. We see that even if I don't have kids who are school age, what happens in public schools matters to me because it forms people and forms our future adult citizens. Similarly, if sex is something other than, you know, getting your teeth cleaned, if it's something that is formative for us and shapes who we are as persons, then what you're doing sexually is my concern. Not in a police force sort of way, not in a nagging sort of way, but in the fact that we're mutually interested in who the other person is becoming.
Let's go to the phones. Michael is on the line from Boston. Hello, Michael.
Hi. I'm concerned about any sort of communal control over sexuality, even the definitional one of claiming that sex outside of marriage is somehow not real, because sexuality is a great lever of control for people. And I think once society or a religious group or a political group, God help us, gets a hold of it, you can start to convince, well, if you have someone convinced that someone else has a right to tell them about their sexuality, you can convince them of even more absurd things, like someone else has the right to send them to a war or has the right to tell them what drugs they can put into their body, or even that God allows billions of people to be tortured in a dark cellar forever and ever.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Let's get a response.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I would definitely want to make the distinction between saying in, for example, a church community, as a body that has sort of committed to have common life together, this is an area of life that is what we in our ecclesial community will discuss with one another. That seems to me far different from saying this is an issue of governmental control. I do not mean to suggest that there should be governmental intervention or somehow legal intervention. That would seem to me to be a state church issue.
But how do we distinguish this then? If it's a matter of societal concern, if it matters to a society how people are conducting themselves, how does that not become at some level grow into a public policy issue?
I suppose I would say we have to agree on sort of what our base level assumptions are. And my base level assumption is that in a Christian vocabulary, we reserve sex for marriage. When I enter the public arena, I'm entering that as a person who's clear about my Christian convictions, and that is part of what I bring to the table in a public conversation. But I wouldn't say we legislate from that. I would then say the burden is on me to say, what is good and beautiful about that? Is there something, for example, about how marital sexuality is different from premarital sexuality that those of us who are committed to kind of premarital chastity can help discuss in a wider conversation?
Well, you know, Joseph Campbell is quoted as saying that one of the things he realizes is that marriage is not a love affair. A love affair has to do with immediate personal satisfaction. It's an ordeal. It means yielding time and again. And he's talking about this bond that ultimately becomes a building block. And are you talking about marriage then as a building block of society, that if the marriage is strong, the society is strong?
I think marriage is a building block of society. I do not mean to suggest when I say that marriage is somehow preferable to non-marriage. I think that the church, in particular evangelical churches in this day and age, are almost idolatrous when it comes to marriage and the nuclear family. And so within the church context, we often seem to be suggesting to be a grown-up, to be a real member of the society, you have to be married. And so I would definitely want to make a distinction. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, marriage might be the normative place for sex, but that doesn't mean that marriage is the only way to be a full member of society.
Yeah. I went to a wedding. I was invited to a wedding on the Seneca Indian Reservation. A friend was married, and we were in the longhouse, and the tribal elders were conducting the service. They were all in the center of the longhouse with their backs to the bride and groom. And for an hour, they spoke to us and went around, you know, sort of looking at each of the quadrants of this longhouse, talking to us in Seneca. Didn't know what they were saying. And then in the last 3 minutes of this thing, they look at Joe and Hillary, and they said something, and Joe and Hillary, the bride and groom, said something back, and then
that was that.
Off to the reception. So what did they say? Well, it turns out they were talking to us, the community, telling us about the importance of this union and warning us about all of the things that could go wrong in a kind of a good housekeeping checklist way of worried about infidelity, worried about not being responsible partners, and that it was our responsibility to make sure this union lasts because this community depends on it and its future relies on the stability of this relationship, and you all out there at the Longhouse are responsible for it.
Well, and we see that in Jewish and Christian wedding ceremonies also. In many Christian ceremonies, there's a moment at which the minister will address the congregation and ask, will you uphold this couple in these crazy, extravagant promises they're making to each other? And the community says, we will. And there's a similar wonderful tradition in Jewish wedding ceremonies that after the wedding, for a week, the couple doesn't go on a honeymoon. They go to different dinner parties every night for 7 nights with members of their community. And I think that's a wonderful way of marking not only does a wedding change two people's relationship to each other, it changes those people's relationship to the larger community in a way that should be recognized and celebrated.
877-962-9862. Kanisha's on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Kanisha.
Hello. I am so delighted to hear your guest. I can't wait to go and get the book. Sounds so interesting. Just wanted to make a quick comment. The idea of waiting to have sex until you're married, to me it seems that the assumption behind that is that you will get married. I personally believe that marriage is not for everyone. It's quite a tremendous undertaking that not everyone is capable of making and honoring throughout the rest of their lives. And the last thing I'll say that is I personally waited to be sexually active until I was 20 years old. It had nothing to do with religion. I saw a lot of girls in my high school being teen moms. I did not want that for myself. I also very much wanted to go to college and to be a writer. And I just wanted to throw out there that you don't necessarily have to be affiliated with a particular religion in order to choose to be a virgin or live a life of abstinence. And that somehow seems to get overlooked. I don't know that we're out there in the majority, but it does happen. But I just wanted to get the author's take, particularly on the idea that everyone should get married or you should wait for marriage until you have sex.
I think you've raised two great points, and certainly I think we've seen in the last few years what certain media pundits have sort of trumpeted as the new virginity or the new chastity, that there are, particularly among younger people, a decision to wait, perhaps not until marriage, but to at least wait a few more years to be sexually active. And I think there's a generational and sociological explanation of that. I mean, we been living with the sexual revolution for 40 years now, 30, 40 years. And I think folks my age, in folks in their 20s, teens, are seeing that there are some worrying and negative consequences of some of the extremes of sexual behavior in our society. And I don't think that it takes religion to diagnose that.
You've talked about and advised college students to get married rather than have sex. And I suppose the counterargument is that, no, we should live together, get to know each other, and find out whether this union really has a future.
Well, there does seem to be, again, sociological evidence that actually if you live with someone, if you cohabit with someone before you're married, you're actually statistically more likely to get divorced. And I don't know that anyone has adequately explained that statistic. I suspect that it's because if you are living with someone and you sort of train yourself to know that you can get out because you're not married, then what changes when you do get married, and how do you retrain yourself to think, no, now everything looks the same, but I have this deeper level of commitment?
877-962-9862. I'm talking with Lauren Winner, author of Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. You can join our conversation as Violet has done from Chapel Hill. Hello, Violet.
Hello.
Hello.
I just want to ask how she would suggest that young people explore their own sexuality within the teachings of the church. Sometimes it teaches young people to kind of suppress their own sexuality, and how once they do get in a marriage, how they take sex off of the pedestal and develop their own sexuality without thinking of it negatively.
That's a great question. And that is part of when I suggested a few minutes ago that the church has talked about sex in negative terms with these sort of scare tactics. Sex is bad or dirty or dangerous, and that is why you shouldn't have sex. I think it's particularly an important question for women. And one of the points that I do make in Real Sex is that the church has maintained this idea that guys are really horny and want to have sex all the time, and they have to rein in their sexual desire, but that women and teenage girls are sort of naturally chaste, naturally pure. And if they want to not have sex, all they have to do is fight the peer pressure to have sex. I think that's a real failing in Christian conversations about sex, because it neither helps young women who are trying to remain chaste. It doesn't actually teach them how to discipline desire, nor, as the caller pointed out, when a woman gets married and finds out that, hey, she actually enjoys this, does she have categories for thinking about that? Her categories may be guilt. So I think particularly in the issue of how we talk about female sexuality in the church, we have a lot of work to do.
Talk a little bit more, and thank you very much for the call, Violet. Talk a little bit more about this business of discipline versus, say, a deeper understanding of about our sexuality. Is this a question of, because when you say discipline, the first word that comes to mind, my mind, is repress, and that never feels very good, never feels quite right. So is it a matter of discipline, a kind of a white-knuckled resistance, or how do we understand?
Interesting. I don't think of discipline as a white-knuckled resistance. I like to remember that chastity, that is not having sex until you're married, and when you are married, having sex only with your spouse, is just one of many spiritual disciplines or spiritual practices that the church has taught for centuries. When I was working on the book, a friend of mine was talking to me about fasting, which is another of those spiritual disciplines. And in fasting, we don't decide that we're not going to eat because we think food is bad or because we think eating is bad. We decide that we're not going to eat because we believe that somehow in that process we're able to turn towards God in a particular way. And my friend that I was speaking with told me a wonderful little vignette. He said that he's happily married, but like all happily married people, he sometimes finds himself sexually attracted to someone other than his spouse. And when that happens, he fasts for a day. And the fasting from food reminds him that he does not have to act on all of his bodily desires. So just as he can abstain from food, he can abstain from chasing this woman who's not his wife. So I like to contextualize chastity in these larger spiritual disciplines.
Well, you also say that sex becomes another way for two people to realistically engage in the strengths and foibles of each other.
Yes, and I think that gets at the essence of how marital sexuality might be different from premarital sex. Marital sexuality, by definition, is very ordinary. Sometimes it's going to be swinging from the chandeliers and crazy exciting, but often it's very domestic, it's very routine or ritualized, and that is something that's quite different from having sex with your boyfriend of 3 months. So, for example, after my mother died, I think as anyone who's gone through bereavement knows, that has a huge impact on your libido, on your sexual drive. And so for my husband to engage me as a whole person who for that season was not, you know, excited to have sex every day of the week was an important part of that engaging each other in our foibles. And over the lifetime of a marriage, you have all of those seasons in your sexuality in a way that you aren't likely to have in just casual dating relationships.
How much do you think our confusion about sex, you talked about sort of various ideas we have, you know, men are always horny, women are naturally resistant, these ideas have to do with the fact that we don't have the vocabulary, we really don't properly understand. I mean, I'm thinking, even in Dante's Inferno, you have Francesca saying, well, you know, we were just sitting there on the bed alone in a room with my brother-in-law reading a dirty book, and all of a sudden, I don't even know how it happened to us. You know, this notion that somehow sex just kind of happens to you and there's nothing you can do about it.
Certainly, I think most of us have had the experience of being caught up in passion, and that is a great experience. But we can control our sexuality. We can have self-discipline about sexuality. And sort of where the fasting analogy that I made a moment ago breaks down is that indeed we have to eat to stay alive, and we don't have to have sex for particular seasons of our lives. So that passion is great in its right context, but I think as a descriptor of how sexuality always functions is fictional.
You devote a large part of the book to advocating for single people. Do you think Christian churches overlook single people in their focus, as you said, almost an idolatry of marriage?
Yes, particularly I think evangelical churches tend to tacitly or explicitly suggest to unmarried people that they're not really full members of the community until they marry. And you can see that even in seemingly innocuous symbols such as, do you invite single people into full church leadership? When you look around your church committees, is everyone who's in a leadership position on a committee, you know, a married father or mother of three? And given that the number of single people in America is increasing year by year, also given the fact that Jesus never married, so here the person at the center of our faith who is embodying a life fully lived was an unmarried person, and given that the early church fathers seemed to suggest that living a single life was actually preferable to marriage, the Protestant church in America is getting this the balance off, I think.
Yeah, and it gets back to, I think, Michael, our very first call, a fear that he raised that churches have used this in the past really as a form of control. This was not always a sense of spiritual union and how we might find a closer relationship with God. This was guys in control of their church and in control of women.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it would be very naive to discuss Christian sexual ethics through the centuries without saying there has been a piece of wanting to, in particular, control women's bodies and women's sexuality. And part of those early church fathers who venerated singleness, part of that was about being misogynistic and not thinking that women were full participants in what a holy life looked like. I don't think it can all be dismissed as being about misogyny, but that's certainly a piece.
Are the churches getting better, Christian churches anyway, getting any better at talking about this?
Talking
about sex and about the role of sex in and out of marriage?
Some days I feel that we are, and some days I don't. I have been pleased at the response to my own book, particularly in this issue of an openness to say, yes, we have been discussing women's sexuality in perhaps a strange and distorted way. So I feel encouraged about that.
We're talking with Lauren Winner, author of Girl Meets God and Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with Lauren Winner, author of the spiritual memoir Girl Meets God, also Mudhouse Sabbath, and her most recent book Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. Lauren Winner grew up in North Carolina. She's a visiting professor at Duke Divinity School with us today in the studio. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Talked earlier, Lauren, about your spiritual journey from a Reformed Jew to Orthodox, then to Evangelical Christian. Was it difficult for you to make that transition? I mean, did you feel any sense of guilt, in a sense, going from Judaism?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think that I wrote my first book, which in part is a story of that conversion process, as in some ways an explanation to some of my Jewish friends about what had happened. And I think I still feel some guilt. But I also think I've moved to a place of saying, this is where I have been led, and this actually gives me an opportunity to think about some of the connections between Judaism and Christianity, and perhaps to do some educating in the church about Judaism. I think there is just a tremendous amount of misinformation and misunderstanding in the church about Judaism. But I think for anyone who has made a spiritual journey that involves some ruptures, and if you look at the statistics, more and more Americans are practicing in a spiritual religious tradition that is not the one in which they grew up. There can be some hard feelings in families, some confusion with friends and communities. So I think that's a universal or at least very common ambivalence that people experience.
Let's talk a little bit about this growth in spirituality and this and people who are seeming to try to find some kind of a deeper spiritual understanding and practice. Are all spiritual practices, do you think, ultimately different paths up the same mountain? And does it make a difference? Are we moving to a time when we can sort of dispense with various practices and take a look at the question of union?
I actually think it doesn't help anyone to say that all religious traditions are essentially the same. I think that we can appreciate the commonalities and similarities between different religious faiths, but I actually think that we can appreciate them better once we also acknowledge that there are some real differences in terms of how different religious traditions conceptualize what, for example, what an afterlife might look like, or what prayer looks like, or what spiritual practice looks like. There are certainly similarities, though, between some of the spiritual practices. And I think we've seen in America a renewal of interest in some ancient or medieval Christian practices, like styles of monastic prayer, or people who are themselves lay people developing relationships with monasteries. And those practices, I think, have quite a bit in common with sitting Zen, with practicing yoga. And I actually have this pet theory that one of the reasons Christians are more and more sort of rediscovering some of our ancient liturgical prayer and other spiritual practices is because after the great immigration reform of the 1960s, with the influx of a lot of immigrants from Asian countries bringing Buddhist practice to America, Christians have said, we're really attracted to those type of practices. Maybe we don't necessarily have to become Buddhist or sit Zen. Maybe there are similar practices in our own tradition that we can draw on that are really part of our Christian heritage.
You talk about the similarities, I think, in Mudhouse Sabbath, where you talk about the Sabbath in particular as that time, a sacred time when you can, first of all, surrender, mm-hmm. and secondly, allow whatever inspiration there may be mm-hmm. for you to set in. Tell us about the Sabbath and the importance of that to you.
Well, this is, again, one of the things that I do really miss from Judaism. Ostensibly, Judaism and Christianity have in common that they practice a Sabbath. But in the contemporary moment, I think Christian communities have an awful lot to learn from Jewish communities about what it means to have a day that is truly a day of rest and a day that is separate from the rhythms of the week and work.
One of the it would seem from reading scripture that surrender is one of the most important themes. Certainly in Christianity, the sublime moment in Christianity is the surrender of Christ Jesus, and that doesn't seem to be a part of the current culture in Christian practice in the United States. The idea of surrender, of letting go,
I'm not sure it's a piece of any practice in contemporary America. I think we are so in our culture so obsessed with productivity and accomplishing, and what can we say we did at the end of this day and this week, and have such a high veneration for autonomy and individualism that it's very difficult to say, I'm going to give this God or this text or this community some real authority in my life.
So in even getting back to the notions of chastity, our ideas about, I think we talk about the second wave of feminism gone haywire, for mm-hmm. instance. That's a reference you make to our understanding about sexuality and autonomy, mm-hmm. our right to mm-hmm. have this mm-hmm. This freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think in the Christian vocabulary, we don't have a right to sex. In sort of post-sexual revolution America, everyone takes for granted that we have a right to sex. And I think back to the question of Sabbath, the way that we inhabit time is analogous. Is there an order of time that God has created or that our religious community has ordered that we are stepping into? Or is time something that we possess and own? It's interesting to me, even the language we use for time in the 20th and 21st century is language that we've borrowed from banking. We spend time, we save it, we manage it. In the 19th century, people used the idiom of passing the time. Now, if you heard someone say that, you'd think, well, that's quaint and curious. But there's a real different attitude towards time captured, I think, in those different idioms. When time is something you spend and save, it's yours. You do with it what you wish. To speak of passing the time, I think, is to speak of sort of entering into something larger than yourself.
And you talk, too, about the busyness. It seems to me the concept in modern thinking is that whatever you have is something you earned. But it also seems to me that in Christian text and even in Jewish text, the idea of earning your keep isn't there. The idea
Absolutely.
Is that it is a gift, and that's a central teaching in
Absolutely.
Christianity.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that idea of gift is shot through all of Scripture, both Jewish and Christian, from the very outset of creation. I mean, creation is a gift to us. The fact that we are here able to have this conversation with one another and are sustained daily to do that is gift.
Is that so? You're in divinity school. What's going on there? Is this a discussion that's being had? Do as priests and ministers go out and teach? Is this a theme that they feel needs to be addressed and has not been addressed quite properly?
Well, I do hear a lot of discussion that I'm very encouraged about what it means to have an understanding of creation. If we are the creators of everything, our lives and societies are going to look one way. If, as both Judaism and Christianity teach, we are creatures and not creators, then our vision of what the good life is going to look a little bit different. And I do see that conversation happening in both Christian communities and Jewish communities.
I'm just wondering if it's a robust debate, if there are folks who feel, look, this is not the world we're living in. You can't start telling people to expect gifts and give away their time on a Sunday and not do anything.
Well, there's a huge difference, obviously, between sort of the theology people say they subscribe to and what they do on a day-to-day basis. So I think most Christian theologians would say we should live in God's economy of abundance. Most of the time, most of us live, though, as though scarcity were the rule of the day. So hypocrisy is nothing new.
What drew you to evangelistic, to Protestantism and the Anglican Church? Why not become a Catholic, for instance?
It's interesting. I think a lot of people have asked me why I didn't become a Catholic, in part because there's this idea that if you're an intellectual, and here I have spent my entire life in schools and higher education, that you will become a Catholic if you are in a Christian tradition, that great Catholic intellectual tradition. I was very drawn to Anglican and Episcopal expressions of Christianity from the get-go. Of course, in part, this was because I was baptized in England, so when in Rome, do as the Romans do.
Well, then you'd have been a Catholic. Oh, go ahead.
When in Cambridge, England, do as the Cambridgians do.
Okay.
So I actually see a great deal of similarity between Episcopal Anglican expressions of Christianity and Judaism. Both are people of prayer books, liturgical praying. Both, I think, have a similar appreciation for tradition, that you Scripture is your authority, but that you take quite seriously the larger rabbinic or church tradition. So in that way, you know, Anglicanism is quite close to Catholicism.
You talked about some of the guilt you felt leaving the Jewish tradition and becoming Christian. Is there an apology you feel you have to make as an intellectual when you subscribe to a faith tradition and you talk about faith?
It's interesting. When Girl Meets God first came out, I was interviewed by someone who said, do you think your academic career will take a hit because you've written this sort of confessionally Christian work? And I said, no, I think it will take a hit because I've written something, you know, quote unquote, popular. And I actually have found that academia is much more anxious about doing, you know, writing for a broader audience about any topic than maybe they are about confessional religious commitments. You know, there are some Christian academics who've made sort of a cottage industry out of saying the academy is hostile to Christianity. I personally don't buy that. I mean, I think if your work is good, your ideas are good, you'll find the right conversation.
Well, on the other hand, because this conversation does seem to be being had more and more, is the academy becoming more friendly to faith tradition?
Well, certainly I think universities are recognizing that religion classes and religion departments are both more and more popular among students and also crucially important. I mean, people in the Academic Guild of Religious Studies scrambled, of course, after 9/11. Do we have anything useful to say? What have we been teaching about Islam? How can we explain certain right-wing Christians' crazy statements after 9/11? So I think there was a lot of scrambling. And then again, after the recent so-called values election, which is a term that I would dispute, but that conversation for another day, there's been again a discussion sort of between journalists and academics about, okay, what's going on in American culture and society, and can academia help us explain this?
When it comes to faith, though, is there some kind of a division when you think about a faith tradition or a faith experience? Are you, as an intellectual, sort of harvesting information? Are you as guilty of trying to become the creator of your own conversion experience as one who learns about faith versus having a kind of mystical, more mystical sense of your journey?
And I think that anyone who writes in the memoir genre, whether or not you're writing about religion or spirituality, it is a strange place to, in effect, be a participant observer of your own life. And then do you spend the rest of your life taking notes, you know, for the sequel?
Well, and do you make a distinction? I mean, do you have a different sense of an observation that you've made by reading this and sort of have this aha moment having read a great work, or an inspiration, the mermaid dream that comes to you in a far different form.
I think all of us hope that we are sort of more integrated people than that. And I don't think of myself as sort of putting on one hat or one pair of glasses when I step into my office at Duke and another hat or another set of glasses when I'm home or at church or at my desk. So I see what I do in universities and what I do in my church community and what I do at my kitchen table to all be of a piece.
Do you find, you talked about the values election, clearly people can be stirred up, and the notion of values is something that's very important, particularly when they're harnessed to religious belief. Are the divisions among us overdrawn? Do you think that there's probably
Absolutely.
More that unites us than divides us?
I think the way the distinctions have been drawn is false because yes, there are many evangelicals who are very politically conservative. I'm not one of them. And so I personally, frankly, really resent this idea that it was the evangelicals who were Republicans and voted Bush into office. There were many self-identified evangelical Christians who were appalled by Iraq for religious reasons, who support a living wage as a religious value, support peace as a religious value, a Christian value. So I think there's a lot more diversity of political views in a theologically conservative religious community.
It's probably important to make a distinction between evangelicals and fundamentalists.
Yeah, I think that's a helpful distinction, although sometimes the distinction gets blurry. But I think there are evangelicals who are part of the religious right who would say, if you're a religious Christian, you've got to be politically right-wing. Mm. And I would dispute that both theologically but also descriptively, that there are many theologically conservative Christians who are not out there beating the band for our current presidential administration.
What's your next project?
I'm desperately trying to finish the last chapter of my PhD dissertation.
Ah, so, well, we'll let you go then, because you got work to do.
I'm sure you'll want to have me back to talk about that as soon as it's done.
Absolutely. A work in progress. Lauren Winter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren Winter is author of Girl Meets God, Mudhouse Sabbath, and Real Sex, currently a visiting professor at Duke Divinity School and working on her PhD. That's the state of things for today. Thank you very much for listening. You can send us a comment at sot@wunc.org. Our show is produced by Corey Princell, Megan Davis, John Blythe. Robin Copley is our technical director. Dave DeWitt is managing editor. Susan Davis is senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.